Investors Chronicle.
Hello and welcome back to the IC Interviews. I'm Mary McDougall and we've got a special treat for you all today. I'm delighted to welcome veteran journalist and author William Green. William has spent much of the past couple of decades interviewing many of the world's most influential investors for a slew of the world's top publications, including Time, Fortune, Forbes, Bloomberg, The Economist and The New Yorker. He's worked on several books, but last year he published the brilliant Richer, Wiser, Happier, which I'm sure many of you have read, and if you haven't, I recommend that you do. The book draws on hundreds of hours of interviews with more than 40 of the world's most successful investors, from John Templeton to Charlie Munger, to help shed light on how to win in markets and in life. William, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Mary. I'm delighted to be here with you.
Well, I was delighted when you told me that your dad was a loyal IC subscriber. Was that might have been in the days of the legendary Harold Wincott.
You know, what I didn't tell you that I did this intentionally is my father died 18 years ago today. So I actually scheduled our interview on the day of his death anniversary. So in some sense, this was my way of paying tribute to my father, who loved the Investors Chronicle and loved the stock market. Wasn't a great investor, didn't have a great temperament for it, but was a passionate investor. And I think one of the reasons why I became obsessed with investing is that I remember as a child, I would see him sitting in our living room in London, reading the Investors Chronicle, reading the Financial Times, sitting there with a glass of whiskey and sort of checking his stocks. And so I think I had this sense that there was a magic in the stock market. And so it feels very fitting to be doing this today in honor of my late father. So I hope he's looking down Barry Green and thinking, God, how come my son is actually talking to this journalist from my favorite publication? So thank you for having me on today.
Well, what a lovely story. I hope we do him proud. You start the book by saying that you've been obsessed with investing for over 25 years. You've said in podcasts that you wanted to sort of learn how to make money. I think you were already a journalist when you started investing, but I wondered why you stuck with writing about investing rather than being a money manager yourself.
Yeah, it was probably a dumb decision. I would have become much, much wealthier if I had gone into investing. Even if I had been a mediocre investor but was doing it professionally, I probably would have become wealthier than a very successful journalist or author. So it was probably a poor decision on my part. But I think one of the things that I learned from working on this book and from interviewing so many great investors is that I'm not them. There's a huge gap between their skills and mine. And also temperamentally, they're much better wired for this game than I am. So I tend to be fairly fearful, fairly anxious, somewhat pessimistic in the way that many journalists tend to be. We always assume that the world is going to hell, which is probably pretty good for a journalist because you can write about all the awful things that could happen, which makes for engaging journalism. But it's not great for an investor. You need to have some faith in the future that it's all going to work out. So I don't think I was wired well for the game. And when I see the best investors, I can just see they're optimized for this game in a way that I'm just not. And I remember Charlie Munger, who was this brilliant 98-year-old polymathic genius who's been Warren Buffett's partner for the last 40 or so years, he said at one point that if, for example, he said you have to play games that you can win. So he said, for example, if you're 5'1", you don't want to become a basketball player and play against people who are 8'3". He said you've got to find something that A, you have an advantage at, B, you have a deep, passionate interest in. I'm interested in investing, but I don't think I would want to spend my life sitting there poring over financial statements and going to visit companies. I'm more interested in things like the psychology of great investors, what makes them so well suited to this game, and how they deal with questions like the fact that the future is unknowable and that everything is changing, and yet we have to make decisions that are rational about the future. That's a sort of, it's an almost philosophical question, which really interests me and has great practical ramifications, both in investing and life. So those are the things that possess me. And I wish I just wanted to sit in a room like Warren Buffett with the blinds shut and just read annual reports. I'd be a much wealthier man, but maybe not wiser, who knows?
Well, you've certainly had a very interesting career with unprecedented access, from what I can see, to some of the biggest legends in the field. You talked a bit about not having the right personality traits yourself, but one thing that struck me from reading the book is that there are a lot of commonalities between the people that you feature. Many of them live remotely, are described as pragmatic, contrarian, thinkers, resilient. They all read huge amounts. What do you think are the most important commonalities between the successful investors, and to what extent do you think these can be learned?
One of them is simply that they're very unemotional and dispassionate. So they're looking at the markets in this very rational, dispassionate way, waiting for opportunities where the odds of success outweigh the odds of failure. So I think of someone like Howard Marks, for example, who manages something like $160 billion or so at Oaktree Capital Management. I remember during the financial crisis, for example, in 2008, 2009, when everyone was profoundly panicked and it seemed like the world was coming to an end, Howard said, well, most of the time the world doesn't end. And so he's just sitting there very quietly, very dispassionately, watching the markets go to hell. And he says, sometimes the prices are so low that actually, while everyone else seems to think the risk is heightened, the risk is actually lower because you're able to buy such bargains. So over a period of something like 15 weeks, he and his partner, Bruce Karsh, invested something like $500 to $600 million a week. So they bet something like $10 billion, made a profit of $9 billion. And I said to him later, was that difficult for you? Was it emotionally difficult? And he said, no, I don't remember it being difficult at all. And I knew that he'd been divorced before. So I said, were you always unemotional? And was it a problem in your relationships? And he's like, oh yeah, particularly in my first marriage. And he's like, I've got a bit better lately. And so that's just a temperamental advantage that someone like that has, that they're not caught up in the emotion of the market. So if you think of most of us, we're getting swept up in the fear and the greed and the euphoria. So I found this myself recently where I would be interviewing people who had made a fortune on Bitcoin and the like. And it drove me nuts. I kept thinking, wait, am I missing out? Do I need to get in on the game? And you feel this emotional yearning to get in on the game. And then at the same time, I'm like, but I don't understand it. I don't understand if this is actually, how do I value this? Is it just a fad? Is it just another outbreak of irrational exuberance? And then I would talk to someone like Joel Greenblatt, who's one of the great investors of all time. And he just said, yeah, no, it's no problem for me not to play that game. I know what game I'm playing, which is buying stocks cheap and not buying things that I don't understand. And so that kind of rational, dispassionate ability to step back from the market and just say, no, this is the game that I'm equipped to win. That is something that we can learn, to say to ourselves, is this a game that I'm equipped to win? And if it's not a game that you're equipped to win, temperamentally, intellectually, emotionally, in terms of your knowledge, you can step back and say, well, let me outsource this to someone who's better suited to doing it. Let me hire a fund manager who's better at this game, who's got a better temperament. Or let me just index. Let me invest in index funds so that I'm not having to try to beat the market. So the game I'll play is just to keep expenses very low. I'll have no trading expenses, lower taxes, and I'll just keep adding to the pot consistently over many years. So that's a way of stacking the odds in your favor, just by saying, let me admit my own frailties and my own limitations instead of playing games that I'm not equipped to win.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I think one of the reasons I found your book so profound is that it's about so much more than investing. And I guess the clue to that's in the title. But you mentioned Howard Marks and his divorce, the book. You talk about Jean-Marie Evillard talks of not spending enough time with his daughters. Laura Gerrits talks of, time getting away with her and not having children, which she sometimes regrets. To what extent do you think the traits of being a good investor might not be the successes that you think they are for life in general?
There's definitely an intensity to these people. I think if you want to really succeed at an outlandish level in any profession, whether it's being an Olympic skier or a jumper or an author or an investor. You've got to be intense. Charlie Munger read the book and was incredibly flattering, thankfully, about the book. A friend of mine videoed Charlie Munger saying, he asked Charlie, what did you like about the book? What did you find interesting? Were there any insights you found interesting? And one of the things Charlie said is, yeah, how many of us ended up getting divorced? And he said it kind of made sense because the game is so captivating, it's so all-consuming that we ended up neglecting our spouses in many cases. And that's just one of those conflicts in life where you have to decide, what are you prepared to sacrifice? How much are you prepared to sacrifice? But the intensity is striking. There was a wonderful story that Bill Miller once told me. Bill was probably the most successful mutual fund manager of his generation. And he was talking to me about meeting this friend of his, Will Danoff, who manages something like $250 billion at Fidelity and has an amazing record over the last 30 years. And he said when he first met Danoff, someone introduced them at a conference in Phoenix. And he said, I held out my hand to him and I said, hi, Will, nice to meet you. And he said, Will Danoff wouldn't shake his hand. And he just looked at him and he said, I'm going to beat you, man. I'm going to beat you. And I just thought that was such a wonderful insight into the intensity of these people. And there's a guy called Paul Lounsis I interviewed who said to me, look, you don't get to be Roger Federer without playing tennis. And so I think you do have to ask yourself, is it a game that you're passionate about, that you care enough about that you're going to actually try to beat the market? And for me, I'm weirdly obsessive about the things I write about. I can sit around reading about philosophy and spirituality and psychology and things like that pretty much endlessly. It doesn't feel like work to me. And then I see the connections between that and investing, things like dealing with uncertainty, dealing with change. I'll be reading books on Buddhist principles, and I'll be thinking, oh, it's really interesting. They're dealing with the fact that everything changes, that everything's impermanent. And it's totally linked to markets and the fact that everything changes and it is impermanent. So that for me, that's not work. I'm doing that for pleasure. I think that's much the same with the greatest investors. It's not really work for them to sit around studying markets. It's more an addiction for them. It's probably harder actually to focus on the other areas of their life.
Yeah, that's interesting. You do talk a lot in the book about it being a game of odds. You say that Templeton, Bogle, Rain, Buffett, Munger and Miller have figured out shrewd ways to stack the odds in their favour. If investing is a game of working out the odds, do you think this might be getting harder as technology has led to a rise in intangible assets, which can be harder to value, and perhaps as index funds become a more dominant force?
I do think it's harder. I think there are many more qualified people competing. And so in the old days, if you were Ben Graham, for example, who was Buffett's great teacher, you could look around and see all of these companies that were incredibly cheap and that very few people noticed were cheap. Nobody really cared. And so you had a tremendous advantage. Now, since then, we have so many people who are CFAs, who've got MBAs, who are kind of qualified to study stocks and the like. So you're competing with all of them. Then you've got all of these machines that are picking up these little mispricings in the market. So the competition has intensified. On the other hand, the markets are still driven by the same emotional crazinesses as ever. It's still driven by fear, euphoria, excess, greed, all of these things. Those human emotions are always going to create mispricings. And so if you're somebody who has emotional control and you have a few principles that you understand and that guide you through this craziness, you can step back and just wait for the market to do something nutty. And so I think of, I had a lovely example of this the other day where there's a guy I invest with who I won't name him, was a very smart young hedge fund manager, really nice guy. who just owns about 12 stocks. And I just looked at his recent recent quarterly report, and he bought a big position in Peloton. And that's just really interesting to me. Here's a company that had fallen something like 85%. Everyone knew that Peloton was a disaster, that the company had overexpanded, that it was a bubble. But it's like, I use a Peloton pretty much every day. I love my Peloton. It's an amazing company. They keep adding more value to your experience of using it. And so at a certain price, it was crazy, right? And it became a bubble stock. And I'm not touting this as a pick. What do I know? But it had a market value of what, $50 billion or something. But now that it's crashed, or at least when it had crashed a couple of weeks ago, he's looking at it and he's just like, yep, now it's very cheap. And so to have that kind of temperament where you can step back from the craziness and just calmly and rationally say, is this worth more than the market believes it's worth? That's always going to be something that works, I think. And so you just have to have a few very fundamental principles that guide you through the mess. And so one of the things that Joel Greenblatt, who's one of the most successful hedge fund managers of all time, said is, I just want to value a business and then buy it for much less than it's worth. He's like, that's the entire essence of investing. And so you have to say, well, am I equipped to value a business? Do I know how to value a business? And I don't. So I had a vague sense that Peloton was probably cheap at that point, and that it probably was not going to go bust, and that it's probably a great business. But I don't that's more instinctive. I don't really have a grip on it. Whereas my friend, this hedge fund manager, is actually able to analyze it and say, yep, it's cheap now. And now suddenly we're seeing all these companies like Amazon and Apple and Nike are all said to be looking to with interest about whether to buy the company. So that's just a small, but I think emblematic example of how, yeah, the game is still hard, but if you keep your wits about you and you understand the principles of the game, and then you just wait, then the opportunities will present themselves.
Yeah, it's interesting. Have you observed significant changes in the investment process of people that you've interviewed over the course of their career? Because it's quite, John Templeton famously said, the most dangerous words in investing are, it's different this time. But investors also have to navigate a changing world. You've got Azim Azar saying that technology is developing at an exponential rate. You know, the way companies are valued has had to be adjusted. How do you think investors can reconcile these two forces, and to what extent have you seen investors change their process?
I think one of the things that's striking to me is how a lot of the great value investors, which tends to be my tribe, I'm temperamentally drawn to the great value investors, they used to buy stuff that was just incredibly cheap based on current assets. They would look at something that was kind of busted and they would say, yeah, this is so cheap, I'm going to buy it now. And someone like Bill Miller, who I've interviewed probably for 80, 90, 100 hours over the last 20 years, I was interviewing him recently and he said, no, I've actually kind of updated that. Like I can look at things and say, well, it's cheap to what I think it's going to be worth in the future. So I can look at something. He for example, bought Amazon 20 or so years ago, bought a massive position in Amazon, both personally and through his fund, when most people thought it was massively overvalued, it was money losing, and a lot of people thought it was going to go bankrupt at the time. The stock had fallen literally from $90 to $6 a share, and he bought 15% of the company. And so he's looking at that and he's saying, well, I think it could be worth an enormous amount if this works out. And if I'm right, I'm going to make 50 times my money. And if I'm wrong, I'll lose 100% of my money. And so he's done a similar thing with Bitcoin, where he's made an enormous amount on Bitcoin over the last few years, which he started buying $200 to $300 a coin. And he made just vast sums personally on it, because he's looking at things and he's saying, in the future, it could be worth an enormous amount. And so that's an updating of the principle of buying things at a discount that I think is really interesting, where he's willing to look at the future in a way that probably most value investors traditionally weren't. They were focused on the present. So I think you're always having to adapt your principles. Likewise, the ability to hold a stock for much longer. A lot of the great value investors, like someone like Joel Greenblatt, he would buy something like Moody's, for example, when it was incredibly cheap. And then he'd make a lot of money and he'd sell it because it was no longer very cheap. Whereas someone like Buffett would own it for decades and has made billions of dollars. And so I think that's another thing where there's been a kind of updating of the approach where instead of just selling when it's no longer that cheap, you say, well, no, this is going to continue to grow. It's still a great company. So you want to master these traditional principles, these classic timeless principles, like buying things at a discount to what they're worth. But you always have to update them. You always have to say, yeah, but maybe I want to hold on to a company that's going to be a compounder for many years, even when it doesn't seem cheap.
Yeah, I think maybe a section I loved was on Nick's sleep and Zach Sakaria, and that might be not just because they're the UK contingent, but that might be a good example of people who are really looking at how things are changing. They talk a lot about seeking information with a long shelf life. What type of information is that?
Yeah, Nick Sleep and Kay Sakaria are fascinating. They set up this very eccentric, idiosyncratic investment firm called Nomad that was a kind of metaphysical, spiritual experiment. They were exploring the idea of quality, what it would mean to live a high-quality life, to run a fund in a high-quality way, where you treated your partners fairly. And their approach to information was the same. So they said, okay, most investors are focused on all of this ephemeral, meaningless information that's going to be out of date in a few weeks. So they're focusing on quarterly reports. They're focusing on 12-month price targets. They're sitting there glued to their Bloomberg screen, trying to figure out the latest move in interest rates or whatever, and the impact of all of this kind of meaningless short-term data. And so Nick would call this wiggle guessing. Everyone is guessing about the wiggles of the market. And he said, I want to focus on stuff that has a much longer shelf life. So I want to focus on information that is going to help me decide whether this company I'm analyzing has a great destination in, say, 5, 10, 15, 20 years. So is the company doing things that are going to expand its moat, its competitive advantage? Is it treating customers in a way that's going to build their love for the company? Are they driving down costs so they're becoming more efficient? Are they treating their shareholders honorably? Are they treating their customers well? Are they treating their suppliers well, or are they squeezing their suppliers? And so these are all questions with a long shelf life. And so Nick would call this destination analysis. You're looking for a very attractive destination, and then you're asking, is this company doing what's going to allow it to reach the destination? And so this way of thinking enabled him and Zach initially to buy Costco, which was an extraordinary company that embodied what they called scale economies shared. And so as it became bigger, as it achieved more scale, it would share those benefits with its customers. And so instead of just lining its own pockets by making more and more money, it would say, okay, well, so we just had all these amazing revenues. Let's give these cost savings back to the customer to give them an even better deal. And so as they became bigger, their size became a competitive advantage. And so then when Amazon came along, they saw the same thing and they said, oh, wait a second, this is a company that's driving down costs so much for its customers. It's so efficient and it's giving its customers so much value that it also has scale economies shared. And so what they ended up doing is buying these enormous positions, both in Amazon and Costco, that they've held for, I think, 18 years so far in the case of Costco, and maybe 16 years in the case of Amazon. And so this is a totally different way of viewing the world. It's an incredibly helpful way of viewing your own life, of saying, okay, what's an appealing long-term destination? Where do I want to get? And what am I doing actually? What are the inputs that are going to help me reach that destination? So this is one of the things I love, where you can take a principle from investing and you can see actually it's so robust, this idea of destination analysis, that actually it applies whether you're a company like an Amazon or a Costco that's hugely focused on the long term, or whether you're an individual like you and me and you're thinking, okay, so how do I reach the destination where I'm going to have a successful career in 10, 15, 20 years, or I'm going to have a good marriage, or I'm going to have a good relationship with my kids. And so always in a world where most people are incredibly short term and they're wiggle guessing in the market, or they're just checking their Twitter feed or their Facebook feed in the short term, they're constantly obsessed with the short term. If you can push your outlook out further so that you're thinking about long-term destinations and how to reach them, it's a huge competitive advantage. So the more superficial and short-term the rest of the world becomes, the longer term you want to become. And it's hard. And so we all look at what people like Nick and Zach achieved and we're like, wow, that's so cool that they've owned, you know, Amazon for 16 years and Costco for 18 years or whatever. But it's really hard for us to do it.
What do you think is the main motivation behind these investors and why they're investing? Because the way you describe these people, they're very rich, but they're also, many of them are thoughtful, unflashy people that seem to have integrity and don't seek the limelight. So it's hard to see that it's just about the money. Why do you think these brilliant minds have applied themselves to investing rather than quote unquote nobler causes such as science or engineering or medicine?
I think a lot of them initially are driven by money. I think some of them in the early years, they want to get independence and to have control over their own life and not to be subordinate to irritating bosses and to have to take orders. So sometimes it is money early on. Then there's just the sheer joy of the game. I think there's something about how captivating the game is. I remember Howard Marks saying to me once, we have played and we have won. And there was something very, very simple and pure about it, that kind of joy of taking on all of these other people at a game that's very difficult and winning. That's captivating. But I think as people get older, at least for the investors I've interviewed, there has to be a little more depth. If it's just about playing this game and becoming rich, it's a pretty stunted life. And I think it's fascinating when you look at someone like Nick Sleep or Kay Sicaria, for example, that they basically quit at the age of 45 and they returned billions of dollars to their shareholders. And they said, yeah, we're going to spend the second half of our lives figuring out how to give the money away in a very similar high quality way. We're going to try to find causes that have maximum long-term benefit to society. And I was talking to Nick Sleep recently, and he was saying to me, he was talking about destination analysis with his charity. And he was saying, one of the things that he's doing is he tries to do a lot of stuff with kids, early intervention for kids who have very difficult lives, and to provide them with opportunities to go to youth zones where they can work on their resumes or play or anything that will help them grow. And he said to me, I want to be able to sit down in 20 years time and say, yeah, I gave the money away well. And he said, the difficult thing is that I'm not judging myself by other people's standards. I'm judging myself by my own standards. But is that like, that's also the beautiful thing. I'm judging myself by my own standards. And he said he had a very similar approach with investing. He wanted to feel that he could sit down as an old man with one of the shareholders in his hedge fund and feel that he had treated them equitably and decently and fairly. So they could sit there and share a glass of wine on a veranda as the sun was sinking and feel that he had done the job well. And so that for me is a beautiful thing, that idea that he's taking his ability to play this game of investing very well in a very rational, hyper-rational way. And then he's using that talent to lift up other people by giving the money away sensibly and in a long-term way. And I I think that just makes for a happier life. I think that's one of the great lessons for me of the great investors' lives is that the ones who are just focused on amassing billions for the sake of it, there's something about it that makes you feel kind of depleted when you study them. And I ended up not really writing about those people. I wanted to focus on the people who, yeah, they're great at the game, but they're not so obsessed with the game that they let everything else go to hell. And that's a good model. I think part of what you want to do is hold up alternate models to people and say, you don't actually have to be a snake to get ahead. You don't have to be a stunted individual who, you know, leaves a trail of lawsuits and anger and hatred and bitterness. And there's a different way of doing capitalism that's a little more enlightened. And I remember Charlie Munger saying, I don't want to screw my suppliers. He's like, why would I want to squeeze my suppliers by not paying them until the last possible minute? He's like, my view of life is win-win. And the advantage of that is huge. So you see someone like Munger drawing incredible human beings into his life. And so there's a reason why he and Buffett have been partners for 40 or so years. So I like this fact that these people are good game players, but they don't let the money rule their life. And that's I think a pretty helpful model for the rest of us.
Yeah, and it's a great privilege to be able to give so much back. I enjoyed Helmut Friedlander telling you in the 90s that he had lived uproariously.
Yeah, that was one of the most memorable interviews I ever had. And I can't actually find my notes from it. And so I couldn't write about it very much. But Friedlander was this extraordinary guy who had fled from Berlin. His parents were very powerful in the potash business, which in the, I guess it was for fertilizer, if I remember rightly. And he realized his parents had gone to live abroad, and he was at school one day, I guess it was at college, and heard that the borders were closing because war was breaking out. And he went to pick up his sister from school, who was younger than him. And he said, I stopped to pick up a hat because a gentleman does not travel without a hat. And he fled from Germany and went to the US. And he had this unbelievable life in the US. He was an incredible investor who did everything from trading coffee futures to buying the Empire State Building. And so he's just this great character. And he wore two watches on one on his wrist. He had a Patek Philippe, and then he had this cheap Timex, and he wouldn't shake my hand because of the germs. And this is, you know, 20 something years ago. This wasn't during COVID, and he had this amazing bottle of wine on his desk, or sherry or something. I can't remember. It's like 100 years old. And I said, "Are you going to drink that?" And he's like, "Oh yes." He said, "I had a case of Chateau Petrus recently, and I drank all of it." And he said, "I have lived uproariously." And I just thought, what a wonderful thing to be able to look back at the end of your life and say, "I have lived uproariously."
But I like that you said that you focused on the people that didn't let money sort of rule their lives. Do you think the Buffetts and the Mungers, if they were starting out today, that they would choose investing again? Because the world's changed a lot. And you know, you've got this sort of the Robin Hoods and the index funds, and it's not the same landscape that it was.
Yeah, the Robin Hoods and stuff have really changed the game, haven't they? There's something, everything in our era has been kind of turbocharged. So you were always able to do these dumb things like trade too much and give in to your short-term impulses. And now things like Robin Hood or social media, they've just kind of turbocharged our ability to do dumb stuff that hurts ourselves by being short term. And so I have a friend who's a very renowned investment writer who at one point had set up a Robin Hood account for himself just to see what it was like, and quickly found that he was doing insane stuff. And this is a guy with a superb temperament who understands everything about investing in a long-term way and still falling into this kind of pit. And so I think when you see people becoming more and more short-term and you see all of these temptations, you just want to look at people like Buffett and Munger and say, well, what would they do And I just think they always were wired this way. They were always able to go slower. And they if they were starting now, they'd win the game again, because they have what Munger calls the deferred gratification gene. So while everyone else is going for these instant dopamine hits of trading now, you know, you reach for your phone, you just see people like Munger. They're more like farmers than traders. They find something they like and then they sit on it forever, or at least for many years. It's a totally different mindset. So yeah, I think they would still go into the game, and I think they would still win it, because the more short-term the rest of us become, the more their temperamental advantage would stand them in good stead.
That's a good point. I had a bit of a nagging feeling as I was reading the book, because it makes it sound like a really attractive vocation, and that these are really interesting, thoughtful people, and wondering how that squares with the reality of smart grads choosing a career of, you know, between investment and other things.
I think you have to choose something that's deeply aligned with who you are. And this has been one of the actual profound influences of the book on me, of the process of spending so much time with these people, is I can see that they're acting in alignment with who they are in a deep sense. And I think of someone like Monish Pabrai, for example, who's an extraordinary Indian investor who now lives in Austin, Texas, who he and a friend of mine, Guy Spier, paid $650,000 to have a charity lunch with Warren Buffett a few years ago. And one of the things that struck them was that Buffett talked about living by an inner scorecard. And Buffett said, well, you can tell whether you live by an inner scorecard or not, because you have to ask yourself this question: would I rather be known publicly as the best lover in the world, but actually be the worst lover? Or would I rather be known publicly as the worst lover in the world, but actually privately be the best lover in the world? And what Guy and Monish saw is that Buffett lived totally by an inner scorecard. He's structured his life in a way that's really true to who he is. And that had a huge impact on Monish and Guy. So when I look at someone like Monish, he, for example, he goes into the office late. He has no meetings scheduled at all, no phone calls scheduled, refuses to meet with prospective shareholders because he said, I don't like the whole mumbo jumbo of marketing the fund. And he just sits around reading all day, thinking all day, takes a guiltless nap in the afternoon. And he's just thinking. And then occasionally a mispriced gamble will come along where he sees an incredibly cheap stock and he loads up on it. And then he goes back to doing nothing, basically just reading and thinking and running his charitable foundation, which does incredible stuff in India, lifting kids out of poverty by giving them free coaching to get into the Indian equivalent of MIT. And so he's set up his life in a way that's totally true to who he is. And when I look at that, that makes me think, okay, so I'm not Monish, I'm not Warren. I don't want to set my life up in a way that's untrue to me. So that makes me really look at everything that I do with a similar filter to say, okay, so why do I want to take on that project? No, I don't want to work for someone I dislike. I'm not going to do it. I'd rather give up money than work with somebody I dislike. Or no, it's really important for me to have control over my schedule. It's really important for me to have time to read, to think, to meditate, to hang out with my family. And so these are just very idiosyncratic things. It's just true to who I am. And so just knowing that being aligned with who you are is critical has been very valuable to me. It's a really useful filter. You can remove a lot of stuff that you just think, nah, not going to do that. I remember someone recently saying to me, why don't you start a Substack newsletter? You know, everyone's starting newsletters. I'm like, I'm a slow, ponderous, contemplative human being. It took me like 5 years to write this book. Am I really going to pump out a newsletter every week? It's like, it's the worst thing for me to do. Whereas a podcast, I recently started a podcast, and it's like, yeah, I love to sit around and talk to people. That's really fun. That suits me. And so I think if there's a takeaway for our listeners, it's just to go through that process of saying, what am I built for? What do I actually value? And remove a lot of the unnecessary clutter. Because when you look at people like Bill Miller, Warren Buffett, Charlie Munger, part of their superpower is that they're doing what they're best at and what they love most, and they're pretty much ignoring everything else. And it's almost antisocial. I see it with Monish Pabrai, where he would say, "Look, I'll have a lunch with someone, and I'll say, did I enjoy that lunch?" And he said, "If I didn't enjoy that lunch, I will never have lunch with that person again." And he said, "If when I meet someone, I'll say, is this person going to make me better or worse?" And he said, "If they're going to make me worse, I'll never talk to them again." And so there is something kind of antisocial about it, but at the same time, constructing a life that's true to you and true to your temperament, true to your principles, true to your priorities, that's a really wonderful thing. And it's helpful to be rich to do that. I think that's one of the things that the money has given these very successful investors. But you don't have to be super rich to do that. I mean, I think it's there are things where you can just say, yeah, I'd be prepared to make $50,000 a year instead of $70,000 a year, not to work for somebody I dislike. Or to live in a slightly smaller house so that you can do work that you like, or to drive an old car. I mean, but once you understand what's valuable to you, then you can figure out what you're prepared to sacrifice in order to live that way.
Yeah. There aren't many women in the book, which probably reflects historic trends. There is an interesting section on Laura Gerrits, who invests a lot in emerging markets. But I'm interested to know if you've interviewed Cathy Wood and what you think about her investing style.
Yeah, I would like to interview Cathy Wood. I never have. And there's a part of me that's prejudiced against her approach because she's tended to buy very highly valued, expensive, hot companies, which just temperamentally is not something that I'm aligned with. But that doesn't mean she's not great. And so I just don't know. I have to kind of suspend judgment. The issue of there not being very many women in the sort of pinnacle of the industry is a really complicated one. And it goes way above my pay grade to understand it. But there are structural issues, there are prejudices. It's complicated. And I write a bit about it in writing about Laura Gerrits, who mentioned that when she was starting out in her career, there were just no role models at the female role models at the firm where she was working. I remember her saying that there was one woman at her firm who had just had a kid, and they basically said to her, "There's no way you're ever going to get promoted because, look, you can work from 8 a.m. till 5 p.m. And the other people working at this firm, they come in 7 days a week. They work till 10 p.m. And she just said, you just looked at it and you could see that it was going to be really difficult to have balance in your life. And so she, for many years, said, look, if I was going to compete with the men, I knew that I had to just focus really intensely on my work. And then it kind of got away from her, and she couldn't have kids, and her husband no longer wanted to have kids. It's complicated. And so there's no simple answer here. And there's another very well-known woman investor who I interviewed, who I didn't end up writing about, manages an enormous amount of money. And I remember talking to her about some of the sacrifices she had made, and she has four children. And she said to me, look, I have to exercise really intensely. You know, I can't give up exercise. It's really important for my health. I have to put my kids above everything. And then I manage a huge amount of money and have enormous staff. So I have to do that seriously. So she said, at a certain point, I had to decide, I'm not going to see my friends anymore. And I remember saying to her, what do you read? What's helped you in terms of what you read? And she said, I don't have time to read. I just thought that was really interesting, that for her to balance having four kids and a really successful job, there were things she was having to sacrifice. And it's painful to talk about this, and it's uncomfortable. But it's just stuff that you're having to accommodate to. And when I look at someone like Laura Gerrits, I'm just immensely impressed with what she's managed to achieve in a in a male-dominated industry. When she came from basically a family of Kansas farmers and construction workers and factory workers and the like. I mean, she's just this towering figure. Like I remember looking at her and thinking, you know, she's kind of this diminutive, soft-spoken, really nice, really modest person. You know, if she were a man, she'd be full of braggadocio and sort of thumping the chest and puffed out and feeling full of ego. She's very humble. And I just remember thinking, God, this woman is such a warrior to have pushed her way to the top of this business. The courage and the strength and the determination that took is something kind of awesome about it. So I hope I'm not offending anyone with any of my sort of hidden biases in talking about this, but it's just complicated.
Yeah, I agree. It's really complicated, and inevitably there are going to have to be sacrifices on both sides. But I do think the landscape's getting better. You know, lots of companies are bringing in equal maternity and paternity leave, and that should be a big way to try and overcome these hurdles.
Yeah. And also, again, it's a matter of role models. I have a 20-year-old daughter, and because this book took me so long, I would be for 5 years from the time when she was really a little kid to the time when she was a young woman. I would be going, picking her up from school, and we'd be talking every day about the book. And I remember her at one point saying, "You've got to go big on writing about Laura Garrett. She's the most interesting person in your book. She's an extraordinary character." And it was wonderful for me to see that my daughter, who's really an artist and a musician and a writer and the least likely person to become a professional fund manager, was looking at someone like Laura Garrett and seeing real inspiration there. And so I think part of it also in driving change is to hold up role models and say, look, you can do it. You can succeed in this profession, coming from very unusual backgrounds, with different education, different gender, different race, and also a different mindset, like what we were saying before about holding up people who are behaving in a kind of moral and upstanding and ethical way, instead of just being snakes who are looking out only for themselves. And so holding up role models is a very powerful thing. And I there is a slightly moralistic aspect of the book where I'm trying to show that there's a better way to do this. And that, so when I look at someone like Laura Garrett, for example, I remember her saying to me that she flies all over the place, right? In a typical year, she would spend 6 to 9 months traveling abroad. And she always travels economy class. And she pays for it herself out of her own pocket. And so she's not saddling her shareholders with those expenses. And so I look at something like that and I think, that's a really impressive thing. Somebody who's treating their shareholders honorably. And so when I see fund managers who have egregious expenses, where they're getting hugely rich to perform in a mediocre way, there's a sort of moral failure there. And so just looking at someone who's become a multi-billionaire while behaving poorly, I'm just not interested. I'd much rather showcase Laura Garrett, who I think is...
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus... Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
A deeply admirable human being, and also an interesting human being. I mean, during COVID, I remember talking to her about how she responded to it, and she's such a profoundly intellectual and cerebral and literate person that she basically holed up in a house in Idaho in the middle of nowhere with a stream and 45 books. And she's just sitting there reading. And I just think there's something kind of wonderful about somebody like that, she's building a competitive advantage by understanding the world better than other people because she's reading more deeply, traveling more. And so I love the fact that we can hold up examples of admirable people like Laura Garrett. So that's great. That's part of what I'm up to.
Well, I'm sure we could go on and on, but unfortunately, we're out of time. Thank you so much for coming on. That was really interesting.
Thank you, Mary. It's been such a delight chatting with you.